Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to True Crimes Podcast. Today, I will be speaking with Judith A. Yates. Excuse me. Judith Yates is an award-winning true crime author and criminologist. She has been employed in law enforcement for over 35 years, and she is the author of three books: When Nashville Bled, The Untold Stories of Serial Killer Paul Dennis Reed; The Devil You Know, The Crime They Said Can't Happen Here, which won a 2014 Silver Fascion Award for Nonfiction True Crimes, and a portion of the book's proceeds go to Living Beyond Breast Cancer. And she also wrote a crime prevention workbook called How to Recognize the Devil. All of her books are available on Amazon.com. And she has lectured across the country on crimes and has attended law enforcement schools across the U.S. She worked in loss prevention, the sheriff's department, the federal prison system at each capacity, minimum security to maximum, as a private investigator, as a criminal justice professor and instructor, and a true crime freelance writer. You can connect with her on Twitter and Facebook, on examiner.com, and on her website, judithayates.com. That's judithayates.com. I'm having a little trouble connecting with her, so I'm going to try again. Hopefully she gets through this time. Oh, okay, let me see. I apologize. I don't know why. Wait 1 minute here, and I should be connecting with her. There we go. Hello, Judith?
Yes?
Hi.
Hey.
Thank you for being on. Sorry about
That's
that.
All
right. I had a little trouble with the software.
You know, it's the computer age. It just messes us up. We need to go back to, you know, rotary dials.
Uh-huh. I think so. Just a cassette tape recorder and rotary dial.
That's
the problem. I don't know if you heard. I read your bio.
I did.
And the books you... Okay, good. And so I thought we'd just start. Do you want to start with talking about your books, The Devil You Know, and how you came to write about that story?
Yeah, I can do that. The Devil You Know was definitely, the crime that can't happen here. It happened in Westport, Indiana. It's a little town of a little over 1,000 people where a 12-year-old boy was, quote-unquote, friends with a 28-year-old man who was his distant cousin, Douglas Sims. And Doug ended up murdering Brad. But if you look at the red flags, if you look at the signs, Doug was a child predator. But no one knew what to look for because it can't happen here. And, you know, we don't want to educate ourselves. It's scary. All the things that people say when they don't want to know about bad things that happen or feel like it won't happen to them. He did receive a sentence of 60 years. He'll be released in 2019. It was a very difficult book to write. I traveled to Indiana several times. I became friends with his family and friends. And writing these things are very emotional for me because I am so emotionally involved and attached. But it took several years to write. I'm very proud of it. I felt Brad needed a voice. And like with all my books, a portion of the sales are going to be donated to a nonprofit organization. Brad's family selected Living with Breast Cancer because Brad had lost his mother to breast cancer and later on a stepmother after his death when his father remarried. So I feel like if we don't learn something from these horrific things, then it was all in vain. So that's what I try to do in my books, is do a little education along with the story.
Okay. And the 12-year-old boy, Brad Maddox, were you connected to him in some way? Like, why did you choose his story? Was it a connection there between you and them? Or
I was contacted by a friend of mine who was in the nonprofit sector of missing and murdered children, and she said, you've got to write this kid's story for examiner.com. His murderer is applying for clemency, and, you know, we need help. So that's what I did. For examiner.com, I wrote a series of articles. One of his family members contacted me and said, you know, well, this is wrong, this is wrong. Well, as a journalist, I feel like we need to write the truth. So I went back, I corrected it. Then I wrote another one. They took my articles along with petitions to take to the governor to request clemency denied. And it sort of fell into my lap. I kept looking at it thinking, you know, he's just this little boy, rides his bicycle, loves dirt bikes, has a paper route. He's just all-American kid, and he deserves his story to be told. And that's how it started.
Okay. And now, Sims, now, did you meet with him, the killer, any time?
No. I try not to do that with my books, simply because these people often already have such a self-inflated ego, like Paul Dennis Reed did, and I don't want them to think that they're anything special, anything big, brave, and scary, because they're not. I wrote to him and asked him would he be interested in clarifying some things. He refused, but I did talk to family and friends. And, you know, when you're an author, you kind of have to at times sift for the truth. You know, one person will tell you one thing, another say the opposite. So you keep digging and asking and talking. And a lot of times you have to get as close to the truth as possible. I had friends of Doug, family of Doug, that offered to assist. And so I had friends and family in Brad's, you know, in Brad's team, so to speak. And it sort of all came through into the middle. I also spoke with the investigators. I spoke with police, law enforcement, legal. So it was a lot of interviews, and I don't know how many reams of paper of legal work that I went through.
Wow. And now you wrote that Sims, quote, derided the dead boy in a shocking display before the parole board that left hardened officers stunned.
Yes.
What was
several
that about?
Several officers I spoke with did break into tears when telling Brad's story. Sims did go before the board for clemency and acted as though it was just a walk in the park. Well, what happened? I don't remember. What did you do? I don't remember. Wasn't this boy related to you? I think so. And he might as well have been talking about, you know, he didn't pick up his mail on Monday or Tuesday. It was so blasé and so uncaring. And at one point, one of the clemency board members, she became angry, and she said, look, you killed this little boy. You murdered him. You gained his trust, and you murdered him. Do you have nothing to say? I was drunk. I don't know. And it was just, his eyes were just, you know, one of the officers in the Paul Reed book describes Paul Dennis Reed's eyes like that of a shark, where they just seem dead. Sims was the same way. And it was eye-opening.
Was he, the psychologist, describe him as a psychopath, or?
I didn't really go into the science of the why, or, you know, the psychology, so to speak. I felt Brad's story needed to be told, and I didn't want to concentrate on that stem. I do a little bit of his background. I do talk about the trial where he pled. And you know, some quotes from his good family friends and family members and such. But this is Brad's story.
Okay.
You know, and you can, you know, criminologists, we can argue all day long about what causes crime, were they psychopaths, were they, you know, treated bad as kids. But in the end comes down, a little 12-year-old boy is not going home. And that's what I focus on.
Right, right. Okay, great, yeah. And it won an award, and it looks like a great book. And your next book as well. Now, this one just came out, When Nashville Bled, The Untold Stories. Now, this time, the title says the serial killer's name, Paul Dennis Reed, but mm-hmm. the book is about the victims, right, that you felt were not, or that were not
the
being
focuses,
covered.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The book focuses on the victims' lives. Now, it tells the background of Reed. It tells about his criminal life. It tells about him. But the focus of the book is on victims and the lack of victim recognizing in the judicial and legal system, how the victims are treated, the victim, what I call the victim survivors. You know, they didn't have an identity as Sarah or Angie or Bert. They became the victims of Paul Dennis Reed. And even their parents, their families became the families of the victims of Paul Dennis Reed. They lost their identity. And as a victim's advocate, I feel like that is so wrong in our system. You know, we make these guys out to be big, bad, and scary. He wasn't. He was a punk. He was a punk who shot young, helpless kids in the back for, you know, $1,000, $500. And, you know, no one ever asked, you know, Miss Jackson, what did Sarah like to do? You know, she was an amazing softball player. She played in the school band. What was Bert like? You know, Bert teased. He was the only boy in his family. He teased and teased his sisters. But, boy, you better not ever say anything bad about them. So that's kind of what I delved into, is who were these people? And people need to recognize when they're fascinated with serial killers or fascinated with a crime, the ripple effect of crime means these families, friends, clergy, neighborhoods, schools, they will never be the same again. And that's what people need to realize.
Right. Right. Now, there were 8 victims altogether, right? You had their first names, Sarah, Steve, Andrea, Ronald, Robert, Angie, Michelle, and Jose.
Right. Now, Jose lived. Miraculously, Jose lived. He had several through-and-through knife wounds in his body, meaning it entered his back and came out of his chest. He almost lost a finger. He was brutally stabbed and attacked and beaten, and he lived. Later to identify the person who killed his coworkers and attacked him.
Wow. And now I know that he was, when these killings were going on, they were all at fast food restaurants. Was there a reason why they were always at fast food restaurants?
The perpetrator worked in restaurant business. He had worked in fast food restaurants. He knew opening, closing procedures. The McDonald's in March and the Captain D's in February, those were right down the road from where he lived, from where he worked, where he went to the gym, where he had his post office box for his parole officer. And then when the heat, so to speak, came on in the Nashville area, where they were doing the investigating, he moved to Clarksville. Now, the interesting thing about when he hit the Baskin-Robbins in Clarksville, it was only so many miles away from one of his girlfriend's houses. It was so many houses away from the Kentucky border where he and his girlfriend would go and buy lottery tickets. He knew the area.
Okay.
And he took the victims. He took Angie and Michelle to Dunbar Park where he killed them. He would go to Dunbar Park to walk around with his guitar and his cowboy hat and play music. Well, we call it music. Sitting there at the park over the lake. So he knew the areas.
So if Jose hadn't survived, do you think they would have been able to catch him?
Yes, I think there was enough evidence to convict him, but Jose's testimony really sealed the deal. And, you know, the interesting thing, Jose was in the country illegally. And he, like so many people in this country illegally, wanted to work. He sent most of his money home for his family to survive. He wasn't a criminal. And, you know, to this day, the investigators have been trying to get Jose into the country legally, and it's refused. Now, here, he didn't have to testify. He could have said, you know what, I don't want to be involved. But he sat on that stand several times, very bravely, to the point where he was shaking, sweating, almost crying, and pointed out Paul Reed. But yet,
wow,
he cannot get into the country legally, and he's still, you know, working and living, you know, kind of under the radar because of it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh, yeah. It does seem that you're saying that this is such a problem. Is that why you wrote the book? Because it's just that the killer gets all the attention and none of these stories about the victims?
That was part of it. You know, Reed became a media darling when he was caught. And he wanted to be a singing star anyway. That was his goal when he came to Nashville. And he would call a press conference, and the media would kill each other, falling over each other to get to him. But nobody ever, you know, they even offered to send him fruit baskets and flowers. And
mm-hmm.
no one ever thought to send a note to the Browns or the Jacksons or the Grecus or anybody saying, you know, we're sorry this happened, except they stood on their doors and pounded on their windows and doors demanding a picture of Sarah or tell us how you feel to find out your brother was shot in the back of a McDonald's. And I just felt these people needed their stories told. And a portion of these book sales is going to a nonprofit group here in Tennessee called Parents of Murdered Children. It's the first and foremost chapter in Tennessee for these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do you feel there should be laws or limits to how much media murderers should get? Or do you think there should be some kind of clamping down on that, making them media celebrities?
I believe there are ways that we can keep from making media celebrities. And, you know, Gavin DeBecker, he's one of my favorite authors. He talks about this in one of his books about how the media can keep from treating these people like rock stars. Because there's a saying, rather to be wanted by the police than not wanted at all. And if you look at these people who do these heinous crimes, you know, it is so often an attention-seeking event.
Right.
Now, why did Jim McVeigh bomb the Murrah building? Why did Paul Reed call a press conference when he was in jail? It's an attention-seeking behavior, and yet, and I'm speaking of this as a journalist, you know, somebody often, if it reads, it reads, and if I get the story first. One family who lost a loved one to Reed in the crime, they were literally stalked by one local news reporter. They said every time they looked up, she was parked nearby, cameraman ready. You know, grocery stores, church, at the home, anywhere they went. You know, so many times they'd look up and there's that person. And that should be, that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's wrong.
Yeah. You know, just going back a little bit, I just wanted to ask you, because I know you worked in the prison system. You said minimum to maximum. And we had a big story here in New York earlier this summer. I'm sure you heard about it. New York prison break, where two convicted killers were on the lam. They escaped and for 3 weeks. And they were helped by the prison seamstress. She wasn't a guard, correction there. She was a prison seamstress. She worked there for many years with her husband, Joyce Mitchell. Grandmother, you know, she's married, happily married, had children, grandchildren. And for some reason, she helped these two convicted killers. One was a cop killer. And she helped them to escape. She provided them with tools. She is apparently in a relationship with one of them or was in love with one of them. And I don't know if I wanted to ask you, as someone who worked in the prison system, like, how does this happen? I mean, why did she just throw her life away? Now she's in prison herself. But I'm wondering, how does that happen? Why would that? Why would she do that? I wanted to ask you if you seen that before, or that something that was
yes, good friends of mine. Well, first of all, they're officers, not guards. She was a civilian employee, but it doesn't matter because once you pass through those doors, you're an officer. Now, some people just forget that because they're not in uniform. Maybe it's lack of exposure or not understanding what I call inmate behavior. You can teach about inmate behavior. And I trained rookies. I was a mentor in the program. I was president of the employee club. I did a lot of training. But you cannot train people so much on inmate behavior. Now, there's a very good book that's been around forever, but it's sort of the Bible of this. It's called Games Criminals Play. It is amazing. And they talk about, in the book, inmate behavior, because inmates have time to think about breaking rules 24/7. They know how to apply charm, how to play the game. They have all the time in the world, you know, to work their mark. And there's ways of getting information without being obvious. For example, instead of going, so do you have kids? You would say, hey, sir, are your kids happy that it's time for fall break? And it's all about manipulation. Now, I looked and it said that they're having a review to investigate corruption, prison safety. That's normal after a serious infraction. And there's the 10% rule, and I really need to stress this. 10% of any group is going to be corrupt. Officers, teachers, janitors, construction crews, any group, housewives, you know, 10% of any group will be corrupt. Now, you know, if you look at it, she was a supervisor on a work crew. Think of how you get along with the people you work with. You know, they're, you forget in this business, or some people do, they are... they go from being incarcerated felons to the work crew. And think of how you are with your work coworkers. You joke, you talk, you chit-chat. Inmates are people also. And that fine line can get very, very fuzzy. But you have to remember they're not your coworkers. They are inmates. They're in there for a reason. You are the officer. Somewhere along the way, for whatever reason, you've forgotten it. Now, you know, this happily married, wonderful life, blah, blah, may be true. But they know how to work weaknesses. They can tell what kind of mood you're in simply because of the way you walk, the way you talk, your eye and hand coordination. There's so many ways to figure out. If you go into a shopping mall or any busy area, didn't people watch? And ask yourself, what is this person about? And you can do it. It's really very simple. Well, inmates are masters at this game. So they played on her weaknesses. You know, maybe she wasn't happy. I had a very good friend going through a bad divorce. She felt because of it she was ugly and stupid and fat. Well, the inmate played on it. You're a beautiful woman. How can anyone treat you like that? Next thing you know, she's being walked out for having a quote-unquote affair. So there's ways.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, so you're saying she should be in prison, but I mean, is she more of a victim here than the way you're describing it? It seems like she was just played by these convicts.
I have a very narrow view of the 10% rule when it comes to law enforcement. When you sign that paper, you put on that badge, you are law enforcement. And sure, there's some very sad stories. Sure, they know how to play the game and you don't. But in the end of the day, you're the officer. You walk away from the job. And when you are crooked, corrupt, you put us all in danger. Because in a prison system, there are far more of them than there are of you. I've worked units where there were 100 or more inmates and just myself. So if something goes wrong quickly, it's wrong for everybody. And again, it's a ripple effect. It's not just you, it's your family, it's the institution, it's the prison system itself. It's the town. It's the state. You know, now Clinton Correctional Facility is unfortunately going to be called that place where that officer helps two inmates escape. You know, it's just a ripple effect. And, yes, she should be in prison. She put so many people at risk.
Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, because I was having trouble just understanding how that happened, you know, just really, but the way you describe it, I can see.
Well, think of it this way, too. Yeah. How many people and how many friends of yours that you consider smart, intelligent, well-read, successful people that fall into such negative, harmful relationships? You know, where there's violence, where there's everything negative you can think of, and you sit back and you think, how? You know, what is going on with this individual that they're putting up with this? Well, there's something in them lacking the other person is filling.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens behind bars, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. So, all right, so we have a few minutes left. Is there anything else you wanted? Did you want to say anything about your other book, How to Recognize the Devil?
That's a common sense crime prevention book that I've worked, over 10 years teaching what I call common sense self-defense, not judo, not karate, not stab them in the eyes with your keys, but keeping yourself safe and secure. Now, I cannot keep you 100%. No one can. These are tips, tricks, for example, when you travel, when you leave the house alone, things that you can sit down and talk to your kids about in a way that doesn't make them afraid of the world. And there's a workbook in the book, there are photographs to include weapons made by inmates from common household items. And you can get all of my books, including signed copies, on truecrimebook.net. I will put a discount code on your Facebook page, True Crimes, that people can use to get a discount on these books.
Ooh, great. Thank you. Wonderful.
Well, thank you
for asking me. True Crimes, yes,
sure.
Thank you. Any last words or you want to, before we sign off?
Be safe out there and take care of yourself and your family, and don't drive and drink. Don't drive and text. And enjoy life, because it's very short.
Yes, it is. Yes, Judith Yates, thank you. Thank you for being on True Crimes Podcast.
Thank you so much. Anytime.
All right, take care. Bye.
Take care. Goodbye.